is an incredibly special day in the history of philosophy, which dates back to antiquity. And why is today such a special day, such a historic day in the annals of philosophy? Simply put, today is the day that the age-old free will versus determinism argument will finally be resolved. And it's only costing you $5. Democritus in 400 BC could not solve it. Aristotle in 330 BC could not solve it. John Calvin in 1560 could not solve it. Rene Descartes in 1640 AD could not solve it. Baruch Spinoza in 1675 could not solve it. Arthur Schopenhauer in 1859 could not solve it. But David Prisoner, here at the Dallas Law Search Forum at El Phoenix, will solve it once and for all on March 26, 2019, although it could run into breakfast tomorrow morning. Welcome to the Dallas Law Search Forum. We're a non-for-profit organization dedicated to bringing philosophy, ideas, and intellectual discussion to the DFW area. I'm Rob Olson, president of the Dallas Law Search Forum, and I want to thank everyone for coming out. We meet on the second and the fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. So do we have any first-time visitors? Okay, how do you hear about us? Sir?
Skip told.
Oh, Skip, okay. Very good. You're a friend of Skip, then? Okay.
No, good. I'm
you wouldn't go that far. maybe you trusted him. Yeah. Okay, how about you guys?
My friend Joe.
Okay.
Unitarian discussion group.
A Unitarian discussion group. Okay, there's a lot of Unitarians that come here. Okay, fantastic. Anybody else? Okay, yes.
I looked online.
Okay, so you typed in lecture, and then we popped up. Okay, fantastic. Well, welcome everyone. It's great to have everyone out. We got almost a full house tonight. If you haven't paid already, please do so immediately following the lecture. The cost is $5. David Drum is our treasurer. You can give him the money. If you're a student with an IB, you can attend for $2. Any students out there? We're all students of life, of course, but any students? Okay. And then at $5, like I said, if you want to become a subscriber, the cost is $35 for 6 months. I also want to remind you to pay your bill. Someone inadvertently forgets to pay their bill, and then the Dallas Law Search Forum has to pay for your food and beverage. And philosophy is not cheap, and it's not free. Please be generous with your wait staff. The restaurant is kind enough to provide us this room for many, many years. In addition, we have a website that has a lot of the same information, www.philosophersforum.org. Ken Sauter is our webmaster, and he keeps it all up to date in a very fine way, fine manner. So please feel free to forward the link to others, and let your friends and family know about the Dallas Law Search Forum. And you can also sign up via Meetup. Go to www.meetup.com, Dallas Law Search Forum members. We're also looking for anybody that has an interest in social media, an interest in AV systems to help us out, to volunteer their time, help us a little bit. So if you're interested in that, then please see me after the meeting. Lastly, I want to recognize Ed Stone, a longtime member of the Dallas Law Search Forum. He passed away a week ago. He's presented here at the Dallas Law Search Forum. Amazing gentleman. We will miss him very, very much. Tonight, our speaker will speak for 45 to 50 minutes, and then we'll open it up to questions. As always, try and avoid a Shakespearean soliloquy. Get to your question fairly quickly. And I do believe that Mr. Prusser said that has no problems with questions during the presentation. So if something comes up during the presentation that cannot wait, then you can go ahead and ask them then. Last thing is please turn off your cell phones and put them on vibrate mode at this time. We're very privileged to have David Prusser, JD, with us tonight. He's been a friend of mine, a dear friend of mine for 35 years. We go way, way back. He's always had a strong interest in philosophy, in politics, in psychology. He is a native Texan, born in Corpus Christi. He slowly moved northward, first to Houston, where he met his future wife, Becky, while in high school. And we welcome Becky, prisoner, as well. We're very thrilled and happy that you're here, Becky. While in high school, they met. Then to Waco, where he attended Baylor University for both his undergraduate and his law degree. Then to Dallas, where he worked as a lawyer here in civil litigation. He's board certified in civil appeals. After 25 years of practicing law, he returned to law school to earn an advanced law degree in LLM from SMU. David and his wife also do charity work, including annual trips to Honduras, where they examine people and fit them for prescription eyeglasses. They recently returned from their 10th trip to Honduras. David and Becky have 3 grown children, 10 grandchildren, and 1 very spoiled dog. Dr. David Prisner will be resolving once and for all the free will versus determinism debate. And now please join me in welcoming Mr. David Prisner.
Thank you. Appreciate y'all coming out tonight. I've actually spoken to you in this group twice before and I've always enjoyed it. Okay. Just to quickly let you know where I'm coming from. I am an attorney. I think like an attorney. I literally find that I look at regular daily problems, even like proof of the existence of God, and in those terms, like, okay, there's some evidence, but not conclusive evidence, you know, goes in those boxes in my mind. But being a parent actually has affected me a lot on this topic. So I've been very involved in parenting my 3 kids and 10 grandchildren, and so when one of my daughters talks about how their youngest is just experiencing the terrible twos, I'm thinking, oh, they've experienced that they have free will now. The 2-year-old. And they've decided, when the parent says, everybody get dressed and get in the car, they've decided to exert their free will, you know. Let's go ahead and get started and see if I can get the clicker figured out. You know, the two aspects. We're actually going to look later on. I actually think that there's 3 ends of this question. But the first one, in terms of, this should be bringing in the little, should be bringing in little subtopics in there. Not sure what's going on.
I don't know. Just
let me see if I touch the button. Let me just touch this. And see if it it's just working differently on this computer. Okay, well, that's gonna be interesting.
Yeah. Cool.
When we look at the 2 topics of free will and determinism, we basically define free will as our ability to make a decision on our own, and it presumes that there's more than one possible course of conduct, okay? And that's essential to the whole notion of free will, that things could have gone differently. We could have decided to do something differently than what we did. So when philosophers talk about free will, they will use thought experiments where they say, for example, if you are in a country, and maybe the major dominant controlling political party puts up a candidate, but there's also some rebel candidate. The problem is if you try to go into the polling place, if you try and vote for the rebel candidate, literally they'll, you know, tear up your ballot and maybe beat you, okay? So you basically you have one choice. And surprise, surprise, the major candidate wins. And one person says, well, actually, I did have free will because I went in and I wanted to vote for the major candidate. I always wanted him all along, not the rebel. Well, in a philosophical perspective, the way a philosopher would look at that is, you didn't actually exert free will there because there was never really the possibility of you doing anything other than what you did. That would be determinism. It was determined ahead of time who you were going to vote for. And so that's what the, basically, if we talk about the definitions of free will and determinism as free will, is there could be several courses of action and you choose one, hopefully after making an informed deliberation. And determinism is, really, there's only one course of conduct that your life is going to follow. And so if we look at these two things, there's different ways that you can sort of play with this. That is, you can look at whether or not there is evidence of free will. Well, there really can't be scientific evidence to support free will, and when we live in an era of everything being based upon scientific evidence, why would we possibly believe in free will when there's no evidence of it? Well, the long and the short of it is that we actually know some things intuitively. And scientists have a hard time with this. They don't really like this, but if you think about it, you cannot scientifically prove that we're not all having a dream right now, that this is a dream world. You can only intuitively know that you're awake and trust that that's true. But you can't scientifically prove it. That could just be part of the dream. But I trust intuitive knowledge basically because Blaise Pascal did. That is, Blaise Pascal, tremendous scientist that was so fundamental to modern scientific thought, even units of pressure are defined as Pascals over much of the world, and tremendous scientist. And he said, you know, we know some things by intuition, first principles, and then we know other things by scientific proof. And these are two different worlds we have to operate in. We believe in it intuitively, and virtually all of our language presumes free will. If you just listen to what you say on a daily basis, as soon as you say, they shouldn't have done that, or you shouldn't have done that, or I'm glad you did that, you're presuming free will. So if you take away free will, you can't really say they should have done this, or there's regret, or there's because it was never possible for them to do something differently. If we go a little bit further in looking at free will, this is the word where free will really becomes loaded, and that is a true free will decision in a pure philosophical sense is a decision that is made unimpeded, okay? And unimpeded, of course, is the key word, and it's about a 10-pound word, because what does it mean to be impeded? Well, what if you're making a free will decision, but somebody is heavily leaning on you? That's, you know, that is itself a question. When y'all came here today, you chose where to park. Presumably, that was a free will decision. But I'm going to presume that unless you have a handicap sticker, you did not park in the handicap slots, okay? Well, I guess you could say technically you could have. Your car might get towed, so it was impeded by society's values and by our legal system. It was free will in a sense, but it's very impeded in the sense if you do it, you're going to get towed, you're going to have a heavy consequence. How much is our free will impeded? This is a beautiful slide. I'd love for you to see this whole thing slowed in and tell you all what it's impeded by. But I can remember them. We're impeded basically by our physical laws. Again, go to your parking example. When you pulled into the parking lot, you didn't choose to park up in the air. Okay, it'd be nice. You wouldn't get dings in your door that way. So you're right off the bat, you're constrained by the physical forces. Two, you're constrained by the legal choices. You can't park in the handicapped slot. Three, we're very impeded by society's expectations. And the more I have looked at this question, the more I realize that while I do believe we have free will, the amount of society's expectations that we labor under are truly remarkable. Truly remarkable. You may not think that. You may think we're really individualistic, and you may feel like you make your own decisions, okay? Now, all of you got dressed before you came here, and you chose what you decided you were going to wear. And a good number of you decided to wear socks. I bet that very few of you decided to wear two different color socks where they don't match, okay? It's not any problem. It's not physically, you're not required to wear socks that match. Yet we all wear matching socks because that's what we do. That's what our society does. And so we say we have free will, and you got dressed and you chose your clothing under free will, and yet even as something as basic as the socks that you pull out and put on were extremely impeded by what society's expectations are. But we've only begun to look at what we're impeded by. Sometimes we are driving on the road and somebody cuts us off and we get mad and road rage just boils over and adrenaline is running through your mind and our good deliberate process is impeded by adrenaline or maybe in a different direction, a different experience, endorphins. You can be impeded by so many different things. You could have mental deficiencies. You might have a brain tumor. There is a famous case that philosophers love to talk about where a man lived much of his life, I mean, until he was 40 years old, and suddenly he got into trouble with very serious trouble with childhood pornography and all sorts of horrible things, and it turned out he had a brain tumor. They did surgery and pulled it out, and his aberrant behavior stopped, okay? So he was very impeded by that. So we have free will, perhaps? I think so. But it's so impeded that it's very hard to figure out really how free we are. If we look at determinism, we find that there's not strict evidence of determinism, but the people that strongly believe in determinism tend to be scientists because they see in science, like a hard science, like a Newtonian physicist, every single thing that happens is a result of an earlier cause. There is not so much as a speck of dust going through the universe that was not the result. It was caused by an earlier event, and that was caused by an earlier event, and there's a chain of causation that goes all the way back to the Big Bang. And so they tend to be deterministic in their viewpoint, because if the entire world that they see on a daily basis is all cause and effect, then that means that everything that they see is determined ahead of time. And so maybe even our very thought processes are determined by hormones, determined by our DNA, determined by our upbringing, so that we are merely a machine that's been pre-programmed, so to speak, and we seem to be making decisions, but we're just carrying out our program. If you had a computer and you programmed a robot to go through it and do a bunch of steps and recite language and everything, it might seem to be very interactive, but the reality is that it's pre-programmed, it's determined. There was never a possibility it was going to do something differently. I thought this was fascinating. You know who Nikola Tesla is. He's a sort of a contemporary of Edison and a tremendous inventor, and is largely responsible for the fact that we have alternating current in the United States. He said, man, like the universe, is a machine. Nothing enters our minds or determines our actions which is not directly or indirectly a response to stimuli beating upon our sense organs from without. So determinism is generally things outside of you are influencing you and are forcing you to do certain things, whereas free will is more of internal. People who believe in free will, like myself, believe that we internally derive a decision. So as we look at these two different views, we can sometimes stop and think about the Greek view. This question has been posed since Greek times, and they have a very interesting take on it, and it's best illustrated by the story of Oedipus Rex. Okay, you remember this story. I'll just touch the highlights of it for you. Oedipus Rex was named Oedipus Swollen Foot because when he was born to a king and his young bride, a queen, a seer gave a prophecy that he would murder his father and marry his mother, okay? Not a happy, you know, baptismal prediction. And so they decided to pierce his feet with some hooks and rope and hang him out in the woods and let the beast eat him, so we'll put an end to this right now. And the only problem was the servant that was charged to do this took him a long ways away, and then rather than hanging him up, decided at the last minute just to give him to some other people to raise. And so he's raised in a distant land. Okay. Can't remember, but like he went from Athens out to Corinth. And I think it was Thebes, actually, out to Corinth. And so when he's raised, being raised in Corinth, he believes these people are his natural parents. And he goes to the Oracle of Delphi, and the Oracle of Delphi says, you are destined to murder your father and marry your mother. Well, he didn't want to do that. So he runs away from home, okay? He goes all the way back to Thebes, okay? And on the way there, he gets into a dispute, which could only be called road rage, okay? He got into a dispute with a man about a narrow path in the road and who was going to cross, and they get crosswise, and he kills the guy over it. Well, turned out that was his father. A little later on, he defeats a beast, and he's presented with this queen as his wife, and he marries her. And then, lo and behold, it turns out he discovers he has murdered his father and married his mother. And this is all confirmed because he still has the wounds in his feet from when, you know, they can confirm that this was the same child, okay? So he's very distraught about this, and I believe he pokes out his eyes, and that's the end of the play. It's a feel-good story. The interesting part about this story is it is extremely fatalistic and deterministic, and yet it does not negate free will in many ways. That is, the parents, the original parents of Oedipus Rex, seem to have made a deliberate decision to put a child out in the wilderness, not something you naturally do. And he seems to have made a deliberate decision, free will, to escape and run away. And yet both of these free will decisions end up fulfilling the prediction, the determinism that had been set forth at the beginning of his life. And so the Greeks were what's called compatibilists. That is, they believed that there was free will and there was determinism, but they were compatible with one another. And I think that's probably where I come out. And so this is probably covering an awful lot of the ground right there. As we look at these two right here, I think we ultimately reach a place where we reach a spectrum. And so while the prediction that I was going to lay this question to rest forever might be a little bit grandiose, I do believe that this is the answer. That we have free will, we have some unimpeded decisions, but they are very rare. We have a huge portion of our life that is somewhat impeded. That is, you can wear socks of two different colors, but you're going to take some flack over it, and you're probably not going to do it the second day, okay? If little decisions like what socks we wear are impeded, how much more are decisions about, who we're going to marry or what job we're going to pick? And then there are some parts of life that it's just so impeded, it's just determined ahead of time for us. When I was looking at this spectrum, I started wondering whether we have accidentally backed into the question of the difference between good and evil. Certainly not anything I was planning on covering, but in general, don't we believe that it is better in life for us to freely make a free will decision rather than live like an animal and just have our fate what we do is just an automatic reaction? Let me give you a practical example. Let's say that we, on a daily basis, we decide whether we're going to spend money on something we want or we're going to save it, for maybe some future purchase. And we make this decision all the time. You go to the grocery store, you make all these decisions, constantly decide whether you're going to spend money or going to save it. If we see somebody that makes that and ponders it and makes sort of an informed decision, sometimes does one, sometimes another, and they seem to be exerting free will, we would generally consider that good, I think. I know if I have kids that are doing that, I like it. What about if they're always doing the same thing? They're just so determined, either way, either every time they face the possibility of spending money, they always spend it. I would consider that bad, especially being a father, okay? If they did the opposite, if they never part with money, they're always going to save it, they're never going to spend it. It's just their need, they just can't make a free will decision. I would consider that bad too. So have we accidentally backed into a portion of the question of what we consider good and what we consider evil? In fact, I think one can make a pretty good case that this is what separates us from the animals. That is, animals seem to be perhaps conditioned, but they largely seem to make deterministic decisions. And is that what separates us from the animals? Is that we have free will and animals do not? So I'd like to pause at this point and just throw this out. I'm going to resume the presentation in just a minute, but I'd like to stop and pause at this moment and just put that question out. Is this what separates us from the animals, Rob?
Well, I think this is part of the mind-body problem. I mean, if you assume that there's such a thing as a soul or a spirit or something non-materialistic that's responsible for our free will decisions, then, but if you're a scientist, then you say, well, the mind and body are the same thing, and so whatever the mind does is also deterministic because it's a result of neurons and so forth. So you're talking about animals. I'm not sure about animals, unless you assume that animals have a spirit or a soul that's independent of their you know, material or biological nature.
Okay, somebody else. Do you think this, do you think free will is what separates us from the animals?
Well, I in a talk that I gave similar to this, I gave an example of a tiger. A tiger killed people, you know. And do we blame the tiger? Do we, you know, send him to prison, you know? He has no choice. Tigers do what tigers do. But if a person, a man, is faced with killing somebody, he has a choice whether to do it or not to do it. And therein lies morality. It's a moral decision. And so we blame him if he does it because he does have a choice. And so morality comes in. Animals don't have morality.
Yeah. I just finished reading this book yesterday. And this covers the same topic as well as other things. If you want to know, it's called Homo Deus, and the author is Yuval Noah Harari. He's a professor at Hebrew University. And I want to quote from this page 285 of this book. Free will exists only in the imaginary stories we humans have invented. And he goes on to say, if humans are free, how could natural selection have shaped them? And then he explains, according to the theory of evolution, all the choices animals make reflect their own genetic code.
Very good.
I really don't think there's such a thing as good and evil.
Well,
yes, I don't think there's such a thing as good and evil. I think it's an all or relativistic construction. And we can have examples most recently, you know, people that won't play certain pop stars' music anymore because of things that are coming out about that person. And yet, this year we'll also celebrate 50 years since Apollo 11. And we put a war criminal to work building rockets. And, you know, how, it's just what goal you're after. It's all a relativistic, society-driven, gene survival. Excuse me.
Okay, do you think, I'm curious, do you think that there's a difference between animals and people in terms of free will?
Not at all.
Okay, so basically we are people. I mean, we are animals.
Yes, it's just about genes.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm a scientist, and I know all what's been said about how the neurons, this complex system that determines our decisions, and that it's all reducible to physics and chemistry. But I don't agree with the concept, actually, the way that free will and determinism is defined, because for animals, they don't really have the imagination we have. They don't have the culture that tells us about what we can predict from what's happened in the past. And so they can't imagine themselves in the future and prefer to go one way or another. Like physics, like physical systems, like the planet, if you like, they are pushed from behind, pushed by the past. But humans, because we have imagination, are able to see the consequences of what our choices are, and we can make these choices. If we make good choices, we make pro-social choices that are beneficial to the well-being of the rest of the community. And if we make bad choices, we're selfish and destructive. So it's because humans are different from animals and that we have a vastly greater capacity for imagining the future. And the future particularly is, I would say, unconstrained. We can imagine almost anything that's possible, and therefore we can choose anything that's possible. So I don't see how there's constraints on our choices. The limitations are almost practical.
Okay. Let me catch up on the slide real quick. Oh, you've got to work it now.
yeah, I appreciate y'all's patience with this. It was going to be hard for me to...
In terms of determinism, and I think you were going in this direction, that is, we are basically like animals in the sense that we're largely controlled by our DNA and our upbringing, okay? So the famous debate that you hear about whether it's nature or nurture, your DNA or your upbringing, well, both of them basically come from your parents, right? That's the scary thing. And so in a deterministic world, both of those come from your parents, your upbringing, in the sense of they supply your DNA and the environment in which you're raised. And so this leads toward a deterministic viewpoint. This is the problem I have, and you actually touched on it.
Yeah.
You were talking about we have a criticism of playing Michael Jackson's music right now. And so this is something that Barbara Streisand, one of my favorite philosophers, okay? Spinoza, I've never even seen a movie with Spinoza in it, okay? Barbara Streisand, her, I know. She said this, and she kind of got a blowback for this. She said Michael Jackson's sexual needs were his sexual needs, coming from whatever childhood he had or whatever DNA he had, okay? Now, that's pretty good because determinism looks at your upbringing and your DNA, and it says that's it. That's what controls you. And so, in a single sentence, she pretty much elaborated a deterministic viewpoint. So, as this gentleman is saying, why would you judge him from a moral standpoint? He is what he is, okay? Now, I have a problem with that because it seems to just negate all morality. And so, let me continue on for just a minute here. But I do wonder, you know, sometimes you hear this phrase that says whether you think you can do something or you think you can't do something. Either way, you're right. Whether you think you can or you think you can't, either way, you're right. If you think you can't do something, you won't be able to do it. Now, that particular author is saying, if you do think you can do it, by God, you can do it. Okay, that's pretty good free will advocacy. Either way, you're right. If people believe that they're simply animals, that my sexual needs are my sexual needs, there's no morality. People can't say what I do. Won't I act that way? Okay, that's my perspective.
This says
Barbara Streisand said Michael Jackson's impeded, but he's also impeded by the society's approbation and the society's law, so we should make those stronger so that those impedances override these other impedances.
That's one of the fascinating aspects that we're going to look at this in just a few minutes is when we take this free will and deterministic viewpoint and go into the courtroom with it, because you really do have to ponder whether our legal system presumes that there is free will, otherwise why would they punish you for doing something? On the other hand, if we believe that we don't want you to exert your free will to do that, we want to restrict your free will, we want to punish you, basically condition you so you won't do that. That to a certain extent is a deterministic viewpoint. We are going to keep you from exerting your free will. So, we already covered the Greek view. The slippery slope spectrum, okay. How much coercion is required? If we look at the spectrum of we have free will here and we have determinism here, and yet things like our legal system impact you and punish you if you do certain things, well then clearly our free will is being impeded at a certain extent. We're going to be thrown in jail if you do that, okay? They're trying to impede our free will. And so don't we have sort of a slippery slope in this determination? Think of all the things that we have along here, and to me, when I was down in South America recently, go down to Honduras, and you hear this phrase, plata o plomo. And this is a phrase that you hear down there, and what they mean by this is drug dealers down there will ask you to deliver something. Okay, you're going back on an airline, or you're going to drive a truck, would you just deliver these drugs? And you're not too sure about it, and they decide to help you in your decision. They'll offer you plata o plomo, silver or lead. And it kind of rolls off the tongue. Plata, oh, okay, plata's pretty good. You're going to get silver. We're going to pay you. Or lead. We'll give you a bullet. Okay? So we'll kill you. So free will. You get to free will make your decision, but you're either going to get silver or lead. Now, that seems very cruel, okay, in some ways, but to a certain extent, isn't that what our judicial system does? Is we say to you, you can exercise your free will, but if you decide to do this, we're going to throw you in jail, okay? So, although this is a drug dealer's approach, it is also, to a certain extent, our society's approach. We do not want too much, I think. Rob, you were saying this before the dinner. In fact, y'all covered most of these slides. We actually don't want too much individual free will exercise in our society. Apparently we don't, because we put all these restrictions on it. We will put you in jail if you do certain things. This is another expression that you sometimes hear, golden handcuffs. That is, if companies want to keep their executives or talent from leaving the company, they want to impinge on their free will, they use something called golden handcuffs. That is, they'll pay you now and then they'll put a certain amount of your compensation in basically a bank account. You'll get it next year. And that bank account keeps on getting bigger and bigger. But if you ever leave the company, you forfeit that bank account. So it becomes like someday, like, if I leave, I forfeit $750,000? Like, makes it kind of hard to leave. Have they impeded your free will? Yeah, they kind of have. It's sort of a golden handcuff sort of way. It's a little nicer than the plata o plomo. Okay? But it's sort of the same basis. My question is there a third axis? We've talked about really two axes, two in the spectrum, free will and determinism. Is there a third one? And in the literature, there is. It's not discussed a whole lot, but it's called indeterminism. Okay. So this one is basically, I'm going to make an intentional decision about my life. I'm going to weigh the choices. I can make several decisions. This is, oh, it's just a given. There's really only one course of action. This is, you know, it's not so much that things are determined ahead of time, but sometimes things simply happen by randomness. It's not predetermined in the sense of cause and effect, that you could look at cause and effect, and if you knew enough, okay, if you knew enough about science, you could predict what they're going to do. Some things in life are just random. And to me, this was an important part of life, is realizing there's just certain, you know, I mean, how is it phrased on the bumper sticker? Shit happens, okay? I mean, there are certain things in life that just happen, okay? And so I think that in a well-balanced person, at least this is what I would try to teach my children and my grandchildren, is you've got to exercise free will. That's important to sometimes be held accountable for your decisions. Sometimes you've got to realize this is just determined ahead of time for you. You're just going to have to realize it. It kind of goes along with that old prayer. What is the old prayer? Help me accept the things I cannot change. Help me change what I can change, and give me the wisdom to go the difference. Okay, know the difference. I think it's a beautiful prayer. But I guess I would want to add a third one. It would be, you know, God, help me accept the things I cannot change, change the things I can't change, and also understand that sometimes shit happens. Okay? Not a great prayer, okay? But I think that's a legitimate part of life. Okay? Now, I warn you about adopting too much of this, okay? Because, well, let's picture a wedding, okay? We got a bride and groom, and maybe the groom is a little bit free will, and the bride is a little bit deterministic, and they're taking their vows, and they're explaining why they're getting married, and they say, you know, Becky, do you take David, or whatever? And she says, yes, God determined that you would be my partner, as a decision made in heaven, and we're fulfilling his purpose, and this is, our marriage is made in heaven. Okay, oh my God. Maybe the guy says, well, you know, you're the best person I've ever met. And I have weighed your tremendous attributes, and you are just great. And I made this decision to get married to you, and I'm just delighted with this, okay? That's not bad. What about this guy, okay? Yes, give me this. I don't know. You know, things happen. We're getting married. not a great basis for a relationship, okay? And yeah, I think you're a legitimate part of life. What percentage of our life is free will, and what part is determinism? Well, I believe there is free will. I just believe it's a lot smaller than we think it is most of the time. So let's say we've got a nephew who's like 25 years old and he wants a spouse. Okay, how much does he have free will about this? Well, he probably wants
a woman. So we start off with 7.6 billion people that are in the world, start off at 100% free will, but then he wants a female for his spouse, so he's down to 50%. Now you might think, well, maybe he doesn't want a woman, maybe he wants a man.
Well, then his free will just dropped down to, it just declined by 95%, because there's only going to be a small fraction of the population where he's going to be looking for a spouse. So, but so far, on this guy, particular guy, he's down to 50% of the decision is actually free will.
Well, he probably wants this person to be roughly the same age. I'm not talking about like within a year or two, I'm talking about like with a decade either way, okay?
Well, now you're down to maybe 10% of the people in the world, and you probably want them to either be have your same language or live in the same place as you. It would be pretty hard to get married to anybody and just make a free will decision for somebody who either doesn't live near you or speak your language. They live on the outside of the world, but they at least speak your language. If they don't do one of those two, you're not going to get married to them, okay?
And so we're now down to less than 1% of the people in the world. So if you're going to say, how much free will do you actually have in selecting your spouse, the correct answer might be, well, actually about 99% of it is determined. These people are ruled out. And I haven't even gotten to, you know, things like whether they're the same religion as you or anything like that. We're assuming that they get your free will at somewhere around 1%, okay? This is a, I do like this guy, Schopenhauer. He's a German philosopher. He's a German philosopher, but he's very un-German, okay? He's nothing like Nietzsche. You know? I am German, and there's certain guys that are just really strong, Germanic, you know, I don't know how to describe it, just their philosophy is kind of like a hammer when you hear it. This guy is like a Buddhist, okay? And it's beautiful if you ever read Schopenhauer. And he said this, and I think there's a lot of wisdom in this. Man can do whatever he wills, but he cannot will what he wills, okay? So you feel like you have free will in the sense that you take what you will and then you implement it, but what you will in the first place, you don't get to decide that, okay? So let's enter our legal system. We basically knocked out some theories. Let's see how it plays out practically as we go into the courtroom. And of course, this is my slant. This is my orientation. The reason I like it is in a legal system, you have to actually make a decision. Like, instead of just debating this, you're actually going to decide, here's somebody that sleeps with little boys. Are we going to say, well, okay, fine. Or are we going to punish or put a sanction on it? You don't make a decision. You don't get to say it's an interesting question. So let's look first in our contract law. The traditional view is that the reason we enforce contracts is because of free will. That is the whole basis of enforcing contracts. This has been true for 1,000 years. Is you chose to enter into that contract. You chose to make those promises. Nobody forced this on you. And so because you chose this, we're now going to enforce it. In fact, this is a quote from the Texas Supreme Court. Although it's a recent decision, this is announcing a view that's been around for a good 1,000 years. Freedom of contract is a policy of individual self-determination. Individuals can control their destiny through agreements. Pretty powerful, okay? Don't you feel empowered that we all get to control our own destiny? Okay, so let's talk about our contracts that we enter into. How many of you have an auto insurance policy? Everybody, huh, surprise. Well, the law requires that you have it, okay? Did you know that your policies, although they have different dollar amounts, your basic liability policy is identically worded? Every single one of your policies is. I know this is the area of law I work in. For example, it will cover occurrences. And what's the definition of occurrence? It's an accident, okay? You will have an intentional injury exclusion. It will have a prohibition against assignment benefits. It will have a cooperation clause. They're all the same, okay? So, what happened to free will here? Legally, we're required to get this contract, and they all read the same. Credit card agreements. We all got one of those, right?
Yeah.
You ever read that? Did you agree to it? You it largely consists of you giving away your legal rights, okay? You give the right to bring a class action. If you're going to sue them, you sue them in, you know, Lower Des Moines or whatever. And so, is this freedom of contract? Is this free will? The Texas Supreme Court says we're going to enforce this because you freely chose to enter into this agreement. You could do without a credit card. Except, can you really function in modern society without a credit card?
You can't get anything from Amazon. I was in a parking lot the other day. I could not leave the parking lot without using a credit card. That's the only thing it would take, is to read to get to collect the amount. So, freedom of will? No, not really.
You know, an apartment lease or a mortgage, these pretty much things pretty much read word for word the same. Okay? So, license agreements on Apple's iTunes, you ever read those things? No, why would you read it? Does it matter? If you read a section of it and you don't like it, does it matter? I mean, I'm a lawyer, and I actually care about what's in these agreements, and I've never read a full one. I've read portions of it. I've never sat down and read one. It takes too long. And so, what in the world? We have a legal system that proclaims the boldness that we enforce agreements because they're your free will decisions. I mean, truly, and I'm asking, this is not a rhetorical question, how many of you have actually signed a contract that was not a form? That is, where you actually worked out some terms and had it written and signed, okay? How often do you do that as compared to clicking on, I agree. I agree with all your terms of service, okay?
One thing that you presumably have more freedom is like an employment contract where you may sign a non-disclosure agreement or an assignment of intellectual property. Now, that's really a Hobson's choice, because they're not, you know, sometimes they might negotiate with you, but otherwise you just say, go find another job.
Go find another job,
and
yeah.
Then the other job is going to say, well, go find another job. So, in the law, is that considered, like, coercive, or does the person really have free will?
The funny thing is, the courts will treat it that you had free will, largely. Now, there's certain areas, I don't want to get into a long political dissertation, but there are certain aspects of our society where we realize that these contracts are not the result of free will, and therefore they will put restrictions on us. So when you sign a covenant that says you will never compete with this employer, never in the rest of your life, yeah, the courts will reform that down to where it's something reasonable, like a year, like Dallas County for 1 year, but you could go to Tarrant County, or you could do it 2 years from now. They'll try and reform it. Why? Because they realize you didn't really agree to it. It was coercive, okay? Mm-hmm. It's very rare, though, for the courts to come in unless you're out of strict terms of your agreement. Mm-hmm. Okay, remember our test for free will is whether there's a real possibility of you pursuing a different course of action. Is there really a serious possibility that you're not going to sign the iTunes agreement? Or just say a lot of us have Apple phones. Is there really a possibility that you're not going to sign that you agree to the terms of service? Now, some of you choose an Android phone rather than an iPhone, but I doubt it was because you got out the iPhone terms of service and said, I don't like that paragraph, I'm going to go get an Android phone. One, I know what the lawyers do. They get a terms of service from their competition, and they use the same one with a few changes, okay? They're going to be largely the same. Both of them are going to forfeit your legal rights to bring a class action. They're going to disclaim that you can recover consequential damages. They're going to have as large a giveaway of your legal rights as they possibly can. I know, because I help people work on these things. Okay, let's talk about consent to sex. Ooh, this is an interesting topic. Now, throughout much of history, we considered that free will controls in the sense of either a woman consents to sex or she doesn't consent. Okay, so we either have consent or rape. And this is a very bold line, and we presume that women make a free will determination, and that's it. A more modern view actually looks at sort of that spectrum, that slope, because if you are coerced, or it's your boss, or you're in an unusual environment, or you're on a business trip and you're out of town and you've been plied with alcohol and maybe some other drugs, is a woman really making a free will decision? Well, in our modern society, we're saying, no, she may have said yes at the time, but that was not actually a free will decision. So in our modern society, this whole Me Too movement is largely a question of, quote, free will versus something being forced upon you, and a recognition that this is a much slipperier slope than we ever used to. How about free will and just pure criminal law? Any system that says we are imposing punishment necessarily is assuming free will. You cannot use the term punishment without saying you must have had free will. You might call it something else. You might call it confinement, but you can't call it punishment.
Yes, I can call it negative stimuli.
Okay. It's like a conditioning. Yeah, it's a conditioning, but you wouldn't really say it's a good thing to call it. Operative conditioning is about the future. I don't want you to do that in the future, therefore I'm going to confine you or give you a negative stimulus so you won't do that in the future. Punishment is looking at the past and saying you did something wrong back then, we are punishing you for something you did back before.
But it's a signal to the rest of society that this is unacceptable behavior. So instead of, you can call it punishment, but you don't have to justify it that way. You can justify it in terms of its effect on society.
That's a good point. It is a warning and perhaps operative conditioning to the rest of society that if you do this, we're going to punish you. Okay. So here's a question. Is it a defense in court if you prove that you lacked free will? When I was in law school, I was taught, yes, it is. In fact, that was a part of what was called the McNaughton test, okay? That is, when I was in law school, I was taught there's two ways that you can get off of criminal liability by being criminally insane. One is that you do not understand the difference between right and wrong, usually because you're suffering from some delusion. You don't believe that you're shooting a person, you believe you're shooting a ghost. This is really somebody risen from the dead, and you're that far deluded. But the other part of the insanity defense was, you actually understand the difference between good and will, but you can't stop yourself. Okay, you don't have free will. Somebody calls you that horrible name, you react angrily. I don't have control of myself. That was part of the definition of insanity. That's been removed. Okay, so it's still in the model appeal code. If you are, your mind is such that you cannot conform your conduct to the standards of right and wrong, you just can't stop yourself, okay? In the 70s, we would have called this, the devil made me do it, okay? You won't have free will. But that's been removed in most states' penal codes, including Texas. Why? John Hinckley, okay? John Hinckley shot President Reagan. He was then declared not guilty by reason of insanity. It caused a huge, I actually thought it would be the end of the insanity defense. It was such a huge uproar. And everybody re-examined it and they decided to cut it back. The funny thing is they cut it back in a way that didn't actually make any sense for the John Hinckley case. But nonetheless, they wanted to cut it back. So they took off one of its legs and they shifted the burden of proof over to the defendant. They changed some other things about it to make it harder. But they also cut out this leg to where the fact that you prove in court that you were unable just because of your mental condition that you just couldn't stop yourself, that's not technically a defense of insanity. There are still a lot of attempts to escape responsibility, free will, in criminal law. It basically boils down to, I couldn't help it, okay? We still see it in other ways. One of the ways people have tried over the years is to say I was intoxicated, because after all, that applies. Lots of crimes happen after people are intoxicated. The law just said, no, that's not a defense. Well, the law kind of had to say that. I mean, if that was a defense, every time you shot somebody when you're intoxicated or nice when you're intoxicated, you couldn't convict. There'd be a lot of people you couldn't even convict of a crime, okay? It'd be better to get drunk and shoot somebody than just to shoot them, okay? The battered spouse syndrome, now this is serious, okay? This is basically a version of self-defense. A woman is so battered that she loses her ability to make free will. She just has to kill the guy, okay? And that's actually, it's a version of self-defense. Some people have tried various medical conditions. Hypoglycemia actually has worked fairly well. There have been a number of people who have gotten off from committing a crime. Usually it's a sort of an assault that rises, you know, spontaneously. And they prove up that they actually turned out they were diabetic and they were going into a hypoglycemic problem, and so they just lost control and they did something. I don't say it prevails often, but it has worked sometimes. Brain tumors work sometimes. The Treachy defense has not worked, okay? Doesn't have a good name. How about the Osawenza defense, okay? You laugh about this. Ethan Couch killed 4 people, serving 2 years. Killed 4 people, serving 2 years. What was his defense? It wasn't truly a defense in the sense I didn't commit the crime. It was a defense to the judge that when you're assessing punishment against me, realize that I've been spoiled all my life. Okay. Now, if he was saying that in first person, I don't know if that works very well, but he has a lawyer proving it up for him.
saying, this guy is like, I mean, these parents are terrible. They gave him a car like when he was like 13 and had him start driving himself to school, okay? He's completely unsupervised. He was never punished for anything he did, and he only got 2 years in prison. I was amazed at this, a little outraged, okay? But it worked in that one case. Now, that judge was voted off the bench literally within, like, I want to say within a year.
One time I was hit by a man who had a heart attack, and I was told that he and his estate would have no responsibility for that. But I would think that he might have known that he had a heart condition and then decided not to drive, and in that case, wouldn't he be responsible?
Yeah, in most cases where you have that occur, we're talking about negligence, not criminal law. And technically, just the fact that you have an accident or cause an accident, technically you're not liable for that. You're only liable if you were negligent, which means you were not being careful. Mm-hmm. And if you had a heart attack, then, and you didn't have any prior notice of it, you probably have a pretty good defense. If you've been told 3 or 4 times you shouldn't drive because you could have a heart attack at any time, or you need to be taking these pills and he doesn't take these pills, yeah, you can still have negligence, but it is very hard to prove.
Are you going to do some more?
Yes.
Okay, because there was a lady in England, I believe, who was acquitted of murdering her husband because her defense was she was so emotionally distraught because of PMS, and the jury acquitted her. In the old musical West Side Story, one of the jets said, "Officer Krupke, I'm depraved because I've been deprived." And there was a case of a serial killer, murderer, horrible murderer, up for trial, and his defense attorney said, look, his mother didn't really want him, she was a drug addict, his father was an alcoholic, beat him, he had a horrible upbringing, and you know, you can't blame him because he had this horrible life. And so he's not responsible for all these murders. The judge said, if we allow this, it's a slippery slope. Mm-hmm. This is what you said.
Yeah, and you literally have gone down the path that we're about to go down these future slides, which is fine. This is exactly where I want to go. But let me just stop and go down this sort of dilemma at this point. When the defense attorney says, you know, this guy was so deprived and depraved, as he was being raised, he was beaten and tortured and everything. Stories which are often very true. I mean, some of the background of some of the defendants is truly horrible, the way they were treated. It is very hard to translate that to, therefore he should not go to prison. Mm-hmm. Because if you're saying he doesn't have free will, he's just been so abused. Of course he does these violent things. He can't stop himself from doing these violent things. If I'm a judge, I'm thinking, so are you trying to say I should let him go because I'm not going to punish him? Or I should throw him in jail and throw away the key, because you can't have somebody who's that depraved animal out on the streets. And this is actually where we're going to end up in this presentation in just a few minutes, is that's the case that's headed to the United States Supreme Court in the near future, the John Malvo case. Yes?
Standard ground? Would that attempt to escape responsibility for free will? Surely it is.
Yes, I guess so.
What was the question, David?
The standard ground law in Florida, as it was enacted, is an attempt to escape free will. I'm not sure. It absolves you of responsibility.
That's right.
You get to stand your ground. I'm not sure it's saying I didn't have free will. It sounds to me almost like it is, I have the right to decide that I'm going to stay right here and stand like that. It almost sounds like a pro-free will statute. You know, that you're entitled to exercise your free will. You do escape responsibility.
You have your right to stay there, but then you also escape responsibility for the next thing that you do.
Yeah. It is clearly, and I don't like the statute, okay? It does, a person does get to escape responsibility, but I'm not sure that
that they're escaping responsibility because they're actually saying, I didn't have free will. It almost sounds to me like I get to make the free will decision, then I'm not going to back away. I'm going to stay right here, and the law is going to support me in my free will decision.
But then we conflate the idea that, and I used my gun to enforce my decision.
Yeah.
It's not the same thing. Yeah. That's escaping responsibility.
David, can we let you finish your presentation and then fill out some questions for people that haven't answered yet? Because we're running short on time.
Okay. I think this is an interesting question that the law often faces, and that is the timing problem. And you hit this in the law, and you realize that the philosophers were talking about that. So when I say the timing decision, picture that you're out at sea, and you're in a ship, and you see something like, oh, an iceberg that you want to avoid, and it's 5 or 6 miles away. You got plenty of time just to turn the rudder a degree or two, and you'll miss it easily, okay? The closer you get, the less free will you have, the more emergency thing you have to do to avoid hitting it. And so both in philosophy and in our courts, we seem to realize that the further away you are from a decision, the more time you have to contemplate something, the more we have free will. And the more we are faced with the spontaneous, in-your-face, my gosh, I got to do something, the less we have free will, okay? And this comes up again and again in the criminal law, the defense of sudden passion, for example. Now, this law used to be so strong, and y'all probably heard this story, but it used to be Texas law that if a man found his wife in bed with another man, he could kill them both, and he wouldn't be guilty of murder. It wouldn't just go to a lesser penalty. He was not guilty, okay? Sudden passion. We don't have that law anymore. Okay, you still have sudden passion, but you don't get to say, yeah, I committed murder. At best, these days, sudden passion in Texas law reduces your sentence, but it doesn't absolve you of the guilt of the crime. Okay, let's talk about youth and free will, and this is actually close to where we're ending up, is generally we seem to recognize that youths, they're either not exercising free will very well, or they don't even have free will, because all across the law we say things, you know, like, you know, the kid, sure, he's 16 years old, he decided to buy a car, but he can avoid that contract, okay? Or he decided that he wanted to buy, a lifetime subscription to a gym, okay, he can avoid that contract. Why? Well, somehow we feel that youth, even 16, maybe even 17, that they're really not acting the same free will. Now, isn't that interesting? Because the fact that we see this gradient of free will and we don't really hold a youth responsible as we do an adult, to me says a lot about how we regard free will as an act of maturity, as something good, as something that matures and grows and improves with age, hopefully. Okay? So this is the case, and this is where we were going to end up, is this case is just going to go to the United States Supreme Court, that is, they just granted the writ of certiorari. Do you all remember John Malvo? Okay, mm-hmm. So Mohammed, I think maybe his name is spelled Mohammed, M-U, but he was the older man, and John Malvo was the younger man. He was just 17, and John Malvo was very much dominated by the older man. That is, basically, this young boy basically knew one person that provided him food, shelter, everything. Took him everywhere, I mean, even more so than a parent. And they committed that series of shootings where they actually did it out of the trunk of a car. It was bizarre shootings because nobody could tell. Somebody gets shot in the shopping center. And they're like, we heard shots. Somebody falls down dead, but we don't know where they shot from. You look around, you can't find anybody. This went on for 3 weeks. It was terrifying. They finally caught him through an amazing amount of police work. Muhammad, the senior man, was executed, okay? He very much fell. That's kind of the ultimate decision of that we're going to punish you for a free will decision, and he, the younger man, received 2 life sentences without the possibility of parole. At the time, frankly, I think a lot of people supported that decision because it was just so terrifying when it happened. It was a scary time. But there's been a little further reflection, and the United States Supreme Court has handed down a decision back a few years ago, and it's now being applied, and so this is why it now comes up with him. Is they held that if you were 18 or younger, if you're like 17 or younger, when you committed a crime and you received a life sentence without parole, you can revisit that. You can, you should have a constitutional argument to have that revisited. And one of the things that they use this term in connection with this whole assessment is there irreparable corruption? Okay. Not exactly words I like, but these are the terms the court uses. Is there evidence that there has been irreparable corruption of this youth to where this is why we have to keep him in jail, is there's no possibility for him to be rehabilitated? I think this goes to the heart of free will. I think the United States Supreme Court is saying, if it's established that somebody has no ability of free will, they're so deterministic that they are violent, that they're going to commit crime, we can put them in prison for the rest of their life, even though they were only 16 or 17 when they committed their offense. But if we don't have that sort of proof that free will has been totally removed, then you can't do it. So that will be the issue that goes up to the United States Supreme Court. Okay, let's cover just a quick summary. We solved the problem. Okay, I think we all agree on that. Right? Okay. My conclusions: free will is noble and good, but it is extremely rare. We're not exercising free will an awful lot of time. We are much more like animals than we might want to believe. Even when we exercise free will, our choices are often impeded by a large number of factors, such as our upbringing, our DNA, society's influences, okay? So, as you can tell, I'm sort of a frustrated teacher, trying to give you some homework. Okay? This is your homework. Exercise some new free choice in your life, okay? Wear socks that are two different colors. Something wild and dangerous. Actually exercise free will instead of just following what everybody else does, because that's the way we've always done it. Well, thank you.
We've got about 10 minutes to open it up to questions to those who haven't asked a question.
Yeah, I'd have to go back to Kilton Howard's quotation. And it goes to the definition of free will, because there is the big debate about whether free will is just willing what you want, or willing what you will. And so I just like you to address that, because it seems, especially on the compatibilism, incompatibilism debate, it's just a semantic issue as to what the definition of free will is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I can only tell you my own viewpoint. Obviously, I can't really solve this debate. I can only tell you my own viewpoint is that you don't get to will what you will. That actually is determined by your biology. Now, keep in mind, I was raised in tradition, you know, where if you were homosexual, it's because you decided that, and it's a sin, and you should make other decisions. I don't believe that anymore, okay? I believe that your will is probably controlled largely by your DNA and upbringing. But I also believe that how you handle those wills, how you cabin them in, how you deal with them, that you're responsible for that. That you have free will in how you play that out. Mm-hmm. That's just my viewpoint.
Not free is it the child committing crimes aspect. I'm not quite sure what you're saying. It seems to me whether you try a child as an adult depends more than anything else on the heinousness of the crime, and has nothing to do with any kind of determination about whether the child made a decision freely to commit that crime. Am I overreading that?
No, I think you're actually interpreting the law correctly. That is, the judge at the beginning of the proceedings looks at the nature of the crime and decides whether they basically need to be tried as an adult, okay? And the factors we're talking about actually don't control whether he would be guilty or not guilty. So perhaps I didn't express it clearly, but whether he's an adult or a child, he may well be tried as an adult, but either way, whether he's guilty or not guilty will actually be determined without reference to whether he engaged in free will, but how much he's punished and whether he'll be put in prison for the rest of his life. That is where the courts say, I'm not sure that we can make a decision when a kid was only 17 that we've decided that he's a total loss and he can never become a responsible adult and he's going to go to prison for the rest of his life. And so I think the courts, and us as a society, are saying, You know, people when they're young sometimes do dumb things that are not consistent with what they'll do when they're 30 years old. Hormones are, you know, mature, and things mature, the brain literally matures. And so maybe we ought not to assess that difficult a punishment when we put him in prison for the rest of his life without the possibility of parole.
Question over here, Dave.
What does the LLM mean?
I don't know. They gave me some degree. It's just an advanced law degree. When you get a law degree, the first one they give you actually has the name doctorate, which I think is great. No, but nobody will call me doctor, okay, JD. And then they give you an LLM, and then in theory you go get a PhD in law, which I've never seen.
Does anybody have a question that hasn't asked a question yet? Okay.
Thanks, that was really informative, so I appreciate it. I just had a question about the very last sort of statement on the last slide about free will being noble and good. And I guess it's about the good part. I've recently been reading the St. Augustine and the story about when he stole a pear from the market. Obviously a religious figure knew that it was wrong for him to do that, but decided to exert autonomy against what society wanted him to do. So an exertion of free will in that regard, but it's still being considered a sin. So I'm just curious about how you, not necessarily from a religious standpoint, but how, I guess, one could take the idea of free will and exert it within society to do something negative, and how that would align with the idea of free will being good.
Great question. First of all, congratulations on reading St. Augustine. I know very few people have actually gone and read the story about him sneaking over the wall to steal the pears, okay? Glad to know that's still read. Obviously, guys, I don't have this figured out. I can't speak frankly. I can only tell you my view as a parent and as a grandparent. One of the things I've learned from my wife, the counselor, is that we have to learn individualism. That is, you have to learn to be your own individual, separate and apart from your parents. Mm-hmm. And that is part of what it is to become a terrible two, and it is part of what to be it is to a college kid to steal some pears or to egg somebody's house, okay? At a certain point, you are acting against society just because that is a good moral they put up there. They say don't park here. By God, I'm going to park there because I'm going to prove. And I actually believe that is a healthy decision. It's something we should go through and punish for it. Yeah, maybe that's a part of the learning process too, but still, stealing the pear or eating the forbidden fruit or doing those other things that we do when we're in, you know, high school and college, I think that's part of being good, even though in a very singular sense, the theft is wrong. So.
Anyone that hasn't asked a question, now is your chance.
What about you?
Nope, I've got two people down here that want to ask questions. Okay, Brian, we're going to close with Brian and then Skip.
Yeah, I basically agree with you that we do have free will, but when you say we can't will what we will, I think we do have that freedom as well, because the idea of determinism is based on the prior events determining the future events. But what I was trying to get at before is that by using our imagination and seeing all the possibilities, and if we're reasonably free of impediments, we can use the future to pull us from the present, rather than having the past push us at the present. And so I think there's a problem with the basic paradigm here, that when the hard determinists say everything is determined, even what you're going to will, I think that's a wrong paradigm. A paradigm is a way of looking at things scientifically that is useful for explaining a certain phenomenon.
Sure.
But I think when we get around to human choices, that's an invalid paradigm.
So, and if I understand you correctly, the specific invalidity is you feel like we cannot say that we do not will what we will. To a certain extent, we can look into the future and make some different decisions and control our destiny. And so there is a certain moral factor that we are responsible for in terms of what we will to do.
Yes, thank you.
Well put.
Okay, let's give David another round.
Thank you particularly for allowing